So I see we've got some hands in the room. We also have some people online. I wanted to quickly pass it off to someone I tapped for a first response, Ahmed Kablan with the USAID Bureau for Food Security, and then we'll move along to some additional questions in the room. So I'll pass it over to Ahmed first.
Thank you, Julie, and thank you. Thanks for the presenter for sharing with us their finding, and thank you for OFDA for organizing this meeting and for funding this work. I mean, as you know, post-harvest loss is a critical part for our food security ourselves. By 2050, we are expected that we need to increase food supply or ag productivity by about 48.6%. Food post-harvest losses and food waste contribute as much as more than 50% in the highest estimate. Even with the lowest estimate, it is a food produced not being consumed, and that could be utilized to improve our food security in the future. Food, post-harvest losses and food waste are critical also in terms of where we work in poverty and food security and nutritional outcomes, because food loss is food not being used to be sold in the market and to generate income. It's not food consumed, so affecting food security, but also the nutrition, nutritional outcomes, because especially in the lean seasons, and not to forget post-harvest losses, they are not on the quantity being lost, but also on the quality of the nutrient being lost in the food, especially when we are moving toward more high-value crops, perishable crops that are also rich in nutrients. So improper storage and handling of the food contribute to lower in the quality. And as Jacob mentioned, the food safety angle for it, the application of highly toxic pesticides or insecticides in order to stop the insect infestation, that also represent a food safety risk. And not to forget, these crops or application of this highly toxic insecticide does not stop fungal growth. And in maize and groundnuts and other mycotoxins, aflatoxin is a high risk. So storage in improper storage, such as the jute bags that's commonly used, cheap bags, as Jake mentioned, those also they don't really stop the growth of mycotoxin. Aflastop research from the post-harvest loss innovation lab, the food processing innovation lab at Purdue University, they showed the efficacy of the PEX bags in reducing or preventing the growth of fungal growth, because it creates a hermetic environment inside the bags. So that is another advantage of the PEX bags, and the importance of applying credit to enable farmers to purchase these bags and use them. The other things, I mean, linking this work will be critical with other research investment that we have at USAID, funded by USAID, including the post-harvest loss reduction innovation lab at Kansas State University, including the food processing and post-harvest loss reduction at Purdue University. I think you are linked with Professor Betty Bogusso at Purdue, including some of the work that have been funded with our from BFS also on aflastop by the Meridian Institute, where they looked at the different storage methodology and the efficacy to reduce mycotoxins, the MIT site work that funded by the Global Development Lab, and several other works. And I really did not know if they have funded or are funding some work related also that contribute, as Julie mentioned, to food security and emergency, and the resilience work that linked to the reduction of post-harvest losses. Again, it is a great work, and I don't want to take too much time. I see a lot of excited people who want to ask questions, and as I have the mic, I'm going to ask the first question. On the figure that you showed about the loan utilization, Mira, you showed well, there is one group, about 25%, who used it for household expenses, which is the second biggest group that used it. So did you check the amount, if there was more food stored when they are using this the money to pay for schools, for other expenses, did that trigger less urgency to sell the crops and they stored for a later period of time hoping to get more money and more sale? And if of course, if that did not, the ban on export was not placed, maybe they could have achieved that if that was the case. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your comments and the question. So just for like a clarification before I answer, we will be going back for an N-line survey in May, and we'll be able to get more specific answers to your questions. But like, you know, from when I was there and from like anecdotal evidence, yes, it absolutely means that you do have more maize to store for yourself. And, you know, yeah, does that clarify or? But yeah, hopefully we'll get more specific answers when we go back in May. Thank you.
And also, let me...
Oh, it's on. Good. No, I'd be happy. So we're definitely involved on the drying side of this with the food processing lab at Purdue. I'm involved with that, and that's an important component. And I'd be happy to hear more about, you know, some of the related activities that are going on that USAID's involved with.
Up front. All right, so I'll pass to you. And if you wouldn't, or if you don't mind, let us know who you are.
Hi, my name is Bill Scott. I'm with Dexis Consulting Group. I was very curious to know what was the reaction of the banks, who have a lot of money to extend credit, and also the trader community in these PIX bags. I mean, this is sort of a sea change for them. They've got less food loss in the system. How can you work with them, and what did they say?
Thank you. That was a great question. We've seen in Tanzania, we worked with this local NGO that's a bit more flexible than a larger bank. They actually borrow from Opportunity Bank. Yeah, so they distribute credit to the groups through that bank as part of this. So the local NGO has been pretty flexible in offering this loan. In Malawi, we're working with a more formal bank, First Discount House Bank. They're willing to do it, and they have probably tighter safeguards in place to get their money back, but maybe they're a little bit less flexible. So I think that banks are realizing that there's an opportunity here, that these groups are a potential market, and hopefully this project can show that it makes sense and it's, you know, worth some of the risks that are out there, that these people can be creditworthy if they're part of groups. I think, again, one of the things with Malawi and the desire to focus on legumes was they saw it as more high value. The people that grow legumes probably are a little bit more commercial oriented, and they expect, you know, that they'll be able to get their money back. And then traders. So one thing that just anecdotally we've seen, if you're just buying maize to sell it quickly, the PIX bag probably isn't for you. It's not a trading bag. It's a storage. It's a granary, essentially. It's a storage structure. But the people who are growing or buying to store, it makes sense. That's sort of the market for this.
Send it back to our online audience before we come back to the in-person.
So we've got over 100 participants dialing in today from South America to Sub-Saharan Africa with lots of questions. And we also had Diodone, who I think was from Purdue as well, who was helping answer a lot of these online, but still have some lingering questions here. There were a few questions around some other things that could potentially penetrate the bags, like large borers and rodents, wanting to know if the bags were resistant to that or if that was an issue.
Well, Judene can maybe respond in the chat if I say something wrong, because I'm, you know, an economist. The PIX bags, if from what the entomological research has shown, is that if you have larger grain borer on the inside of the bag, they suffocate too. They can't get through the double layer. So it is effective against the larger grain borer, which is a very aggressive pest. What you need to do to prevent insects from the outside coming in and rodents as well, is the recommendation is to store it on a wooden platform that's a little bit elevated off the floor and make sure your place where you're storing is clean so that you don't have loose maize kernels lying around that will attract rodents. So they start sniffing around. But what we've seen is that if it's a clean area and you store Pix bags with other Pix bags and not next to a non-hermetic bag that the rodents and the insects can attack, it will keep away rodents and will prevent insects from coming in from the outside. So that's an important part of the training as well. We did some follow-up, for example, in Uganda, and it's where we'd done the training, and then we went back, and we saw that most people, we looked at how they were storing and where they were storing, and most people got the message and, you know, were storing it in a safe, clean location and didn't report really too much rodent problem.
All right. More questions from our in-person audience? I think there was one over here. Yes.
I'm Tamara Duggleby, and I'm one of the evaluators for the Innovation Lab projects, which have been implemented in Africa and four other regions, aiming at reducing risk for farmers and increasing their yearly surplus and investment. And I wanted to know, what was the chief mechanism for working with people in groups? I know you had them organize these savings groups. But, and they were in the same communities, obviously, but was there any other contacts, any links between them? Were any of them part of producer groups?
Does that work? Sorry. So these groups, they were already existing by when we went in, you know, because Filatajo had already been working with it. Like the average length of these groups is like 3 years. Their primary purpose is to promote savings within the group and then to create like this pool of money that, you know, anyone who needs it can then borrow from. Some of them do also do producer activities, but actually, you know, like in some of them, there are concurrent groups that focus on like production, for example. These groups primarily, they are like savings. And yeah, exactly. You know, they're linked through communities, through families and things like that. But yeah, again, we did not bring these groups together. And that's one of the reasons why we work with Filatajo. Like, you know, they had these groups established and, you know, they'd been there for a while. So yeah, thank you.
Another question from our online audience?
Sure. We had a number of questions around sustainability, what will happen when the project is over, and what was designed as an exit plan here.
Thank you for that question, and Hira can add on this as well. We're working in Tanzania with the NGO Filatajo to understand some of the more of the challenges and their interest in doing this again. And Hira talked with them when she was there in December, and I talked a bit in October. They say they're interested in doing this again, which is great. They may shift the focus a bit and find, you know, the groups that were the easiest to work with to lend to. I don't know, you know, how they're exactly going to do it, but they say they're interested in doing it. One thing they may do is there was some people said, we wish we got a bigger loan, so $40 wasn't enough. They may make it a little bit bigger to the people that they choose to work with. And they also actually felt inspired to offer for different groups, not the people that were part of this, they offered input loans to people. So they did actually expand their product offering this season for people. So hopefully we had some impact in, you know, encouraging them to try some new things. But we are working with them to expand it. And our project manager, Bernadette, is, very innovative and assertive, and she's looking for some other potential lenders who might be interested in these findings and interested in doing this.
Do you want to add anything? Absolutely. I think everything that Jake said, I think, you know, like the Pix bag, like Filatajo, they really believe in the bag, and, you know, it's true, like, you know, they've seen it, it keeps the maize safe. So, you know, like it really, like it's, they see it as good collateral. And, you know, like when I talk to them, they're really excited about it. One of the things also, you know, like Jake mentioned in Malawi, they're also like, you know, depending on what area they're in of expanding, like the loan to like different products, like legumes specifically. So, yeah.
Great. We've got about 20 minutes left for questions, so we'll keep going with an in-person question.
I'm Mark Mitchell with Land O'Lakes. I didn't hear you mention any of the cost associated with the transport and storage of the collateral grains. Who ate that cost? And what happened if you had any storage of an accidental loss, like the storage shed burned down?
So, like, as far as storing the grain, that was borne by the groups themselves. You know, most of them brought it together in like a central location, which was nearby where their farms were. We had one incident specifically where, you know, there was a problem with the batch of the bags, unfortunately, and there was a loss. So that involved negotiating with, Filetaggio, the lending. That was one instance. Another instance was, and you know, that's when I say when like, you know, people, the Filetaggio really likes this technology because it keeps the maize safe. So in one case, there was, you know, the groups did not want to repay the loan. There was an issue with the price. In that case, they basically got somebody to come and buy the grain. And that was essentially at cost. So they didn't make any money off it, but there was no loss associated with that either. So I don't know if you want to add.
All right, I'll shuttle it over here.
Thanks, Julie. Thanks, everyone, for the great presentation. Patrick Starr, USAID. This is sort of a half-baked question, but I'm wondering if there's if you've studied any minimum necessary percentage, maybe price swing between harvest and the peak sale price, to understand, you know, what kind of crops may be best suited for this model. Especially given the price fluctuations that may not be quite as pronounced for other maybe commodity crops and so forth. So, and then especially when you layer on the interest rates that are applied to loans and different enabling environments that maybe in Malawi might be a little bit different than in Tanzania, could make this maybe a non-sustainable model. But just so that's my question.
Very good question. We certainly did analyses of break-even with maize. I generally think of maize first as the food security crop, and that's the one that's going to have the biggest impact on what we should target. So that was the mentality going into this. But again, as you said, and as we said, you know, legumes, the profit potential may be much higher. Based on our scenarios and what Firitaja was lending at 12% and the price seasonality that we'd seen, we assumed that there would be profit, and there may still be profit. It just may not be as big as we've seen. I think, you know, it's probably worth maybe something that comes out of this kind of a sort of a simple sort of playbook analysis of where the break even sort of, given these interest rate and the potential price fluctuation, you know, what kind of price fluctuation do you need to break even and make this profitable? I think that's a good recommendation for something to come out that others could use in the future.
All right, let's send it back to our online audience if there's another question, and then we'll come back to this table.
Sure. There were some questions about the details around the loans themselves, if the loan was fixed at 40 USD or like what the loan-to-value ratio was. Also questions around the use of mobile money for loan disbursements and how that worked, what the challenges were potentially, and plans for the future.
So for this intervention specifically, the loan was fixed at 40 US dollars. And like, as Jake mentioned, though, you know, like, and like I also said, like, these groups are really heterogeneous. So, you know, hopefully if Filetaggio goes back, there's probably going to be a lot more variation in, you know, the amount of the loan and who they give it to. So the mobile money, so in December, we actually physically went to these locations to talk to as many of these groups as possible. But, you know, like right now it's the rainy season, for example. So some places are just inaccessible to go to. So that's when something like mobile money, you know, it's really nice because, you know, you can communicate on the phone and, you know, they've seen the face. They know like Filetaggio is taking it seriously. So then it's like it's a much more low cost and easier way to get people to pay back. And it allows for greater flexibility, you know, because people have now, because of this price issue, some groups have been paying in pieces, you know, okay, we'll pay half and then we'll pay, you know, we'll pay the rest of it later and things like that. So Mole Bunny is really great there.
Hi, my name is Efia with ADRA International. And my question is about the pig's backs and the drying or moisture content of the grains. So what I've observed is that in countries where they have two or more agricultural seasons in a year, you would realize that they would have a shorter period that the crops can remain on the farm to dry because the rainy season will kick in very soon. And so they have to harvest and dry using other means. And if they don't have the appropriate drying equipment to use, then the quality of the greens are actually affected from the drying stage, even before it moves into the pig's backs. So did you have this challenge? What was the agricultural calendar or planting season in Tanzania like? And if you did, how did you go about it? Thank you.
So this area that we're working in specifically, it is unimodal. There's just one season. So like right now in December, the planting starts and the harvest approximately begins in May and in June. And I think Jake will talk more about
that. And of course, I mentioned briefly, talking about drying is a big part of the training because you want the grain to be dried, of course, before it goes in the pig's bag. If there's mold or if there's any sort of fungi growth and it's dried below 13%, it won't propagate any further in the airtight environment if the bag's closed properly, which is important. If it's too wet and it goes in the bag, it may ferment, because you have this anaerobic environment. But there's no question that drying is a big problem. And in our food processing and post-harvest handling innovation lab, along with the post-harvest loss innovation lab and a number of other projects are trying to figure out the drying problem and how do you cost-effectively dry grain quickly. And it's a big challenge. For most people, they're not at a scale that it makes sense to buy a dryer. How do you get a dryer that people are willing to pay for? What we've seen in our work in Senegal and some work in Kenya on this issue is for a lot of people, the most cost-effective way to dry is just to have a tarp or the roof or someplace clean to get it off the ground, prevent fungi contamination, and try to dry it in the sun as quick as possible and get it in a good storage structure. We had a colleague at Purdue that came up with a low-cost moisture detection device that's about $2 that you can use to tell if you put maize in a bag. It's called a hygrometer. If you put maize in a bag, it for 15 minutes, it'll equilibrate and give you a reading to tell you if it's below that 13% level that you can safely store. So it's a low cost innovation and we're trying to disseminate that as well. But there's no question drying is a big issue.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. My name is José Maciel with Fentrack. Thank you very much for a very comprehensive presentation. And I wonder if you could discuss a little bit about the different levels of uptake on the bags and then on the use of credit available. Specifically, the bags apparently were at 100% uptake, but credit not so much. Was this an issue of the size of the credit or is it the terms for repayment? And I understand you're discussing this moving forward also in Tanzania. So if you could discuss a little bit about that.
Thank you for your question. Yeah, so the loan uptake was around 80%. And so from what I understand from your question, it's essentially like why those 20% like did not want the loan. Yeah, there's like a variety of reasons. So some of them I know were trying to negotiate like a lower interest rate with the credit group. And when that didn't work out, they were like, we don't want it. In a couple of cases, they felt like they did not need the credit. And they would have liked a larger loan and that this was too small. Those were some of the reasons, I think, for
On the PIX adoption, yes, in this intervention, since it was a new product, we did offer 100% subsidy, so it was a free bag for people, so they were willing to try it. What we've seen, and I mentioned this at the end, is in the places where we followed up on that, where we, say, randomly gave people a bag, those people were actually more likely to go out and buy a bag commercially than the people who'd just been trained and hadn't received one. So again, it's like this idea of a new product. You're providing a free sample, essentially, and then you're stimulating the market. What we've also seen, just in terms of adoption numbers, is, for example, in Uganda, where we baseline surveyed in 2014 and nobody had used the bag basically in the sample or heard of it. And then we did our awareness building, our demonstrations, our extension activities, and then went back two seasons later. Adoption was at about 6% in the places where there'd been training. So, you know, in terms of you know, we, of course, we'd love to see it higher, but in terms of just a one calendar year, two season adoption rate, it's pretty good if you think about how long it's taken for some agricultural technologies like hybrid seeds, for example, to get adopted. We've seen in Kenya, after about 2 or 3 years, hermetic storage in Western Kenya, where we did some sampling, is about 7% of people have one bag. In Nigeria, where it's been around for about 10 years, we did some follow-up surveys last year, and adoption is pretty high, about 15-20%. So it's making an impact. But of course, like all innovations, it takes some time.
Great. I'll send it back to our online audience, but we'll get to you next. So one more from our online.
Sure. We had a question around integrating potentially a warehouse receipt type facility, and if that was something you considered doing, or any thoughts on that, to link the financial institution to a collective storage facility for the bag grain.
Yeah, that's a good idea, and it's certainly come up. One of the things when we've looked at like warehouse receipts, it's hard, you know, for the smallholder to access those, in the sense that, you know, they don't have that much to store. They've got to take it to some location that could be some distance away, and then, you know, they're losing control of their food supply. So one of the things people like about those PIX bags is that it's your food in your bag, and you can store it in your house, away from, you know, people who, you know, may want to ask you for some of it or could steal it. So you can keep it, you can keep your food supply safe. And that's a nice thing of the bags compared to the metal silos. For the smallholder, you know, the population that we're kind of working with and that would be interested in the PIX bag, I mean, I think there is some potential, but it may not, the warehouse receipt system may not be the primary storage vehicle for them. I think what has been good in this project with the, especially with the loans, is this idea of this group storage place. So with people you trust, you put your maize in a safe place like the treasurer of the group's house, or in a community place where you know, some kind of central location where you have a locked door. And people, of course, keep their own maize with their own name on the bag, so we know it's this person's maize. But, you know, it's stored collectively as collateral. That may be more, you know, accessible to the smallholder population.
Yeah, no, just that it's, I think for the sample that we're working with, like logistics and cost-wise, it is really difficult to go to, because, you know, Tanzania does have a structure like this, but none of the people in our sample were involved with that. And that's a good thing of working with Filatajo, because they knew these people, so it was stored in like a central location, you know, like Jake said, either at the treasurer's office or in like a local government office. So it's visible to them, and then it's visible to everyone whose grain it is, so, you know.
Hi there. My name is Dan McMahon, and I'm with FinTrack. We've worked a lot with PIX bags in our Partnering for Innovation program and the CAVES project in Kenya. Jacob, I had a question for you about the harvest day loans that you were talking about at the beginning, which seem to differ from the $40 type product that you were mentioning later on. Have you run the numbers on how margins are affected for farmers when they do take out that harvest day loan in a more typical year, one that sees more price fluctuation throughout the harvest, months after harvest. Have you run the numbers on how margins are affected and how much farmers can see an increase in their margins when you account for the repayment of the loan and the interest?
So, so let me clarify. I mean, the idea of this loan was that it's a harvest loan that they got at harvest, at or right around harvest, that they could use to pay expenses and then store. Is that, are you thinking of a different type of loan? I mean, that's the idea where you borrow against the present value of your grain at harvest, which 200 kgs was about $40 in this region. So, we figured if the, on an average year, so $40, you're paying 12%, you know, that's, let's say, what, $5 or something. And then you can, you know, the price will almost double. You can certainly make, you know, $30 or something in profit, $30, $40 in profit on that. So it should work in a typical year. Even with, you know, with $5 interest or something to that extent, you should be able to make it happen. And again, I think we'll see profit for, you know, a number of people, but it just may not be that high.
All right. We'll take one in the far back.
Hi, I'm Shaylee Adenolfi with BankU. We're a blockchain as a service company. And we're exploring similar kind of use cases in various countries. Can you tell me what kind of technology the NGO was using, the bank was using to kind of monitor all of what was happening, and kind of whether you think it would have made a difference in reducing the interest rates?
Thank you for your question. So there are a couple of things. So the primary way of monitoring is like through reports from their network of employees in each district. So, you know, the way they're structured is they have their head office in Bea City, which is the main city in Bea region. And then they have like one coordinator in each one of these districts. And then depending on how big the district is, the coordinator has like one or two people who work under him or her. What they did was, it was because of this project and other projects, was that each of these coordinators had smartphones. And, you know, sporadically, so other than checking up with the coordinators on the phone, they would send them pictures of when the grain was stored, whether there were any issues and things like that. That was primarily how they monitored. And I think, you know, a part of it is that they knew these people well. The groups are also well aware that, you know, they will work with Filatajo on other projects. So, you know, there's like benefit and incentive on both sides to keep like a good working relationship. And that's what they relied on primarily. Thank you.
All right. I think we have time for one last in-person question. And I'm wondering if there's one from someone who hasn't asked one yet. No? Oh, well, all right. I will send one over to Kristen.
Kristen Oplanik, USAID. I was just thinking about this, the credit constraint issue, and as you're saying, the risk in terms of agricultural credit. And I know we've seen success in some of our other activities where they've paired loans with insurance products. And I was wondering if that's something that you had considered. Obviously, the availability of the insurance product is the first issue. But just in terms of consideration, especially vis-a-vis Patrick's question with kind of what the price floor would need to be for all of this to work. And if you could have an insurance product against that price floor, that could be a very interesting solution. Not an easy one, I'm sure, but just something if it had that any consideration there.
So that's an interesting question. So you're saying basically a sort of an insurance on the price, like a revenue type insurance, not an index weather insurance. Yeah, yeah. I think that's really an interesting question. If people would go for that, or if they'll just take their chances, it would be interesting to see what the uptake of that would be. And I think that that's really interesting combined with the loan and the PIX bags. If you know, we could look at that. It wasn't something that we considered. We had our hands full implementing what we had, but it's a great point. And yeah, for future research, it's a great idea.
All right. Well, I like to try and wrap up our seminars right on time, and we're nearing our 11 o'clock end time. But I encourage anyone who couldn't finish asking a question to make connections with the presenters, to type them in online, or to let me or the AgriLinks team know. We'll probably provide some follow-up on further questions in a post-event email that all of you will receive. And so I just wanted to let you know that there is no MarketLinks, no longer MicroLinks, seminar in March, and we're still trying to solidify our AgriLinks seminar for March. But there are actually many links websites at USAID, and there's one called LandLinks that you may or may not be aware of. And they're having a follow-on to the MicroLinks joint seminar from October that will discuss lessons from public-private partnerships for responsible land-based investment in Mozambique. So there's a lot of interesting knowledge sharing seminars stemming from USAID knowledge management websites. So check out landlinks.org if land tenure is in your wheelhouse. And so lastly, be sure, of course, to come check out the PICS bag if you're interested in seeing it in person. And we'll see you hopefully at future AgriLinks and MarketLinks events. So thank you very much for attending.